I am writing to ask him to come to dinner. I have one lady too many. See if I have made it pressing enough. Excuse me, I must leave you for a minute. Please close the envelope and send it, she said from the doorway. I have some orders to give. Without thinking for an instant, Anna sat down at the table with Betsy's note, and without reading it, added at the bottom, I must see you. Come to Vreda's garden. I shall be there at 6. She closed it, and Betsy, returning, sent it off in her presence. Over their tea, which was brought them in the cool little drawing room, the two women really had, before the arrival of the visitors, the cozy chat the Princess Tverskaya had promised Anna. They passed in review all who were expected to come, and their conversation dwelt at some length on Liza Merkalova. She is very nice and was always attractive to me, said Anna. You must love her. She dotes on you. Yesterday she came to me at the races and was quite in despair that she had missed you. She said that you are a real heroine for a novel, and that were she a man, she would have committed 1,000 follies for your sake. Stremov tells her she is committing them as it is. Yes, but do tell me. I never can understand, said Anna, after a pause, in a tone that clearly proved she was not putting an idle question, and that what she was asking about was more important to her than it ought to be. Do tell me, what are her relations with Prince Kalutsky, whom they call Mishka? I have not often met them. What are they? Betsy looked at her with smiling eyes. It is a new fashion, she replied. They have all adopted that fashion. They have kicked over the traces, but there are different ways of doing it. Yes, but what are her relations with Kalutsky? Betsy burst into an unexpected, merry and uncontrollable peal of laughter, a thing she rarely did. You are encroaching on the Princess Mayakaya's domain. That is a question an enfant terrible might put. And Betsy evidently tried to, but could not, control herself, and again burst out into the infectious kind of laughter peculiar to those who laugh seldom. You must ask them, she uttered, while tears of laughter choked her voice. It is all very well for you to laugh, said Anna, who could not help laughing too. But I never was able to understand it. I cannot understand the husband's position. The husband's? Liza Merkalova's husband carries her rugs after her and is always at her service. But what there is behind it all, no one really cares to know. Don't you know that in good society no one talks or even thinks about certain details of the toilette? It is just the same in such cases. Will you be at Rolandaki's fete? Asked Anna, in order to change the subject. I don't think so, answered Betsy. And while looking at her friend, she began filling the little translucent cup with aromatic tea. She moved one of the cups toward Anna, got out a paquitos, placed it in a silver holder, and lit it. You see, she said, I am in a lucky position. I understand you, and I understand Liza. Liza's is one of those naive natures who, like children, are unable to understand the difference between right and wrong. At least, she did not understand it when she was very young, and now she knows that the role of not understanding becomes her. Now perhaps she is purposely ingenuous. And Betsy smiled pointedly. But still, it becomes her. You see, a thing may be looked at tragically and turned to a torment, or looked at quite simply and even gaily. Perhaps you are inclined to take things too tragically. How I wish I knew others as I know myself, said Anna, seriously and thoughtfully. Am I worse than others, or better? Worse, I think. Enfant terrible. Enfant terrible, Betsy repeated. But here they come. Chapter 18. Sounds of footsteps and a man's voice, then that of a woman followed by laughter, reached them, and the expected visitors entered the room. Sappho Stoltz and a young man, shining with a superabundance of health, known as Vaska. It was evident that he flourished on underdone beef, truffles, and burgundy. Vaska bowed to the ladies, only glancing at them for a second. He came into the drawing-room behind Sappho and followed her across the room as if he were tied to her, with his glittering eye fixed on her as if he were ready to eat her. Sappho Stoltz had fair hair and black eyes. She entered with a short, brisk step in shoes with high French heels and shook hands with the ladies with a firm grip like a man. Anna had never met this celebrity before and was struck by her beauty, by the extravagant fashion of her costume, and by the boldness of her manners. On her head, the delicate golden hair, her own and others, was built up into such an erection that her head was as large as her shapely, well-developed, and much exposed bust. At each strenuous step as she advanced, the shape of her knees and thighs was distinctly visible under her dress, and one involuntarily wondered just where, behind, under her heaped and swaying bustle, the real, graceful little body ended, which was so exposed at the top and so hidden at the back and below. Betsy hastened to introduce her to Anna. "Just fancy, we nearly ran over two soldiers," she began at once, winking and smiling as she threw back her train, which she had jerked too much to one side. "I was with Vaska. Oh, but you are not acquainted." And she introduced the young man by his surname and burst into ringing laughter at her mistake in speaking of him as Vaska to a stranger. Vaska again bowed to Anna, but said nothing. He turned to Sappho.
"You have lost the bet. We have arrived first. Pay up," he said, smiling.
Sappho laughed still more merrily.
"Surely not now," she said.
"Never mind, I will have it later."
"All right, all right. Oh, yes," she suddenly said, addressing her hostess. "I'm a nice one. I quite forgot. I have brought you a visitor. Here he is."
The unexpected young visitor Sappho had brought with her and forgotten was nevertheless so important a personage that in spite of his youth, both ladies rose to greet him. He was Sappho's new admirer and followed at her heels just like Vaska. Then the Prince Kaluski arrived, and Liza Merkalova with Stremov. Liza Merkalova was a slight brunette with a lazy, oriental type of face, and beautiful, everybody said unfathomable, eyes. The character of her dark costume, as Anna at once noticed and appreciated, was perfectly suited to her style of beauty. Just to the same extent as Sappho was compact and spruce, Liza was limp and pliant. But to Anna, Liza was by far the more attractive. When Betsy had spoken to Anna about her, she had said that Liza was playing the role of an ingenuous child. But when Anna saw her, she knew that this was untrue. She was really ingenuous, and a perverted but a sweet and irresponsible woman. It is true she had adopted the same tone as Sappho, and as in Sappho's case, two admirers followed her as if tied to her and devoured her with their eyes, one a young and the other an old man. But in her there was something superior to her surroundings. She had the radiance of a real diamond among false stones. This radiance shone out of her beautiful and really unfathomable eyes. The weary yet passionate look of those eyes, with the dark circles beneath them, was striking in its perfect sincerity. Looking into those eyes, everyone felt as if they knew her perfectly, and knowing her could not help loving her. At the sight of Anna, her whole face lit up with a joyful smile.
"Oh, I am pleased to see you," she said, walking up to Anna. "Yesterday at the races I was just trying to get near you when you went away. I was so anxious to see you, yesterday especially. Was it not dreadful?" And she gave Anna a look that seemed to reveal her whole soul. Yes, I never thought it would be so exciting, replied Anna, blushing.
The company rose to go into the garden.
I won't go, said Lisa, smiling and sitting down beside Anna.
You won't either?
Who wants to play croquet?
I like it, said Anna.
Tell me, how do you manage not to feel bored? It cheers me to look at you. You are full of life, but I am bored.
You? Bored?
Why, yours is the gayest set in Petersburg, said Anna.
It may be that those who are not in our set are still more bored, but I, at any rate, do not feel merry, but terribly, terribly bored.
Sappho lit a cigarette and went out into the garden with the two young men. Betsy and Stremov stayed at the tea table.
Bored, said Betsy. Sappho said that they had a very jolly time at your house yesterday.
Oh, dear, it was so dull, said Liza Merkalova. We went back to my place after the races. Always the same people, the very same. Always the same goings on, the very same. We spent the whole evening lolling about on sofas. What was there jolly about it?
Do tell me how you manage not to get bored, said she again to Anna.
One has only to look at you to see that you are a woman who may be happy or unhappy, but who is not dull.
Teach me how you do it.
I do not do anything, said Anna, blushing at these insistent questions.
That is the best way, Stremov joined in.
Stremov was a man of about 50, getting grey, but still fresh-looking, with a very plain, though intelligent, face full of character. Liza Merkalova was his wife's niece, and he spent all his spare time with her. On meeting Anna Karenina, he, like a clever man of the world, being Karenin's enemy in the service, tried to be specially amiable to her, the wife of his foe.
"Don't do anything," he repeated with a smile. "That is the best way. I have always told you," he went on, turning to Liza Merkalova, "that if one wishes not to be bored, one must not expect to be bored, just as one must not be afraid of not falling asleep if one wishes to avoid sleeplessness. That is what Anna Arkadyevna says."
"I should have been pleased to have said it, for it is not only wise but true," said Anna, smiling.
"No, but tell me why one cannot fall asleep and cannot help being bored."
"To fall asleep one must have worked, and also to amuse oneself one must have worked."
"Why should I work when no one wants my work?
And I can't and won't do it just for a pretense."
"You are incorrigible," said Stremov, without looking at her, and again turned to Anna.
As he rarely met Anna, he could not say anything to her except trivialities. But he said these trivialities about her return from the country to Petersburg, and of how fond the Countess Lydia Ivanovna was of her, in a way that expressed his wholehearted desire to be agreeable to her and to show her his respect, and even more.
Tuskevich came in to say that everybody was waiting for the croquet players.
"No, please don't go," begged Liza Merkalova when she heard that Anna was leaving.
Stremov joined her in the entreaty.
"The contrast will be too great," he remarked, "if you go to see the old Countess Freda after leaving this company here. Besides, your visit will give her an opportunity to backbite, while here, on the contrary, you arouse the best feelings, quite opposed to backbiting."
Anna hesitated for a moment. The flattering words of this clever man, the naive, childish sympathy which Liza Merkalova expressed to her, all these familiar society surroundings made her feel so tranquil, while what was lying in wait for her was so hard, that for a moment she doubted whether to remain and put off the dread moment of explanation. But recalling what awaited her when alone at home if she took no decision, and remembering her action, the recollection of which was terrible, when she took hold of her hair with both hands, she took her leave and went away.
Chapter 19. In spite of his apparently reckless existence, Vronsky was a man who hated disorder. While quite young and still in the cadet corps, he had experienced the humiliation of a refusal when, having got into debt, he had tried to borrow money, and since then he had never again allowed himself to get into such a position. To keep things straight, he was in the habit, some 5 or 6 times a year, according to circumstances, of secluding himself and clearing up all his affairs. He called it having a clean-up, or faire la lessive. The morning after the races, he woke late, and without having a bath or shaving, he put on a linen tunic, and, spreading out before him his money, his accounts, and his bills and letters, he set to work. When Petritsky, who knew that on such occasions Vronsky was often cross, on waking saw his friend at his writing table, he dressed quietly and went out without disturbing him. Everyone, knowing intimately all the complexities of his own circumstances, involuntarily assumes that these complexities and the difficulty of clearing them up are peculiar to his own personal condition, and never thinks that others are surrounded by similar complexities. And so thought Vronsky. And not without some inward pride, nor without some justification, he reflected that any other man would long ago have got embroiled and been obliged to act badly if placed in a situation as difficult as his. But Vronsky felt that it was necessary for him to investigate his affairs just at that time in order to keep out of trouble. He began by first attacking his money problems as the easiest to deal with. Having noted down in his small handwriting on a piece of notepaper all he owed, he made up the account and found that it came to 17,000 and a few hundred rubles. Having struck out the odd hundreds in order to have a round sum, counted his money and looked over his bankbook, he found that he had 1,800 rubles and there was no prospect of receiving any more before the new year. After reading over the list of his debts, he divided them into 3 classes, each of which he noted down separately. Under the first head came the debts that had to be paid at once, or the money for which had at any rate to be kept ready, so that they could be paid on demand without any delay. These debts came to about 4,000 rubles, 1,500 for a horse, and 2,500 he had incurred by standing security for his young comrade Venevsky, who, in Vronsky's presence, had lost that sum to a card sharper. Vronsky had wished to pay at the time. He had the money with him. But Venevsky and Yashvin insisted that they would pay and would not permit Vronsky, who had not even been playing, to do so. This was all very fine, but Vronsky knew that in this dirty business, his share in which was simply a verbal guarantee for Venevsky, he must have the 2,500 rubles ready to throw to the sharper and then have no more to do with him. So that for the first part of his debt, he must have 4,000 rubles ready. 8,000 rubles under the second heading were less important. They were owing chiefly for the use of the racecourse stables to the oats and hay dealer, to the Englishman, to the saddler, and others. In respect of these debts, it was necessary to pay out 2,000 rubles in order to be quite secure. The remaining debts were owing to shops, hotels, and to his tailor, and there was no need to trouble about them. So he needed 6,000 rubles for immediate use and had only 1,800 rubles ready money. To a man with an income of 100,000 rubles a year, as everybody said Vronsky had, it would seem that such debts could not cause any difficulty. But the fact was that he was far from having the 100,000 rubles. His father's immense fortune, which alone brought in 200,000 a year, had not been divided between the brothers. When the elder brother, having a number of debts, married the princess Varya Chirkova, the daughter of a penniless Decembrist, Alexei gave up to his brother the income from his father's fortune, stipulating for only 25,000 rubles a year for himself. At that time, Alexei told his brother that this would suffice for him till he married, which in all probability he never would do. And his brother, commanding one of the most expensive regiments and newly married, could not refuse this gift. Their mother, who had her own private fortune, allowed Alexei about 20,000 rubles a year in addition to the 25,000 agreed upon, and Alexei spent it all. Latterly, his mother, having quarrelled with him about his connection with Anna and his departure from Moscow, had stopped his allowance. Consequently, Vronsky, who was in the habit of spending 45,000 rubles a year, having this year received only 25,000, found himself in difficulties. He could not ask his mother to help him out of them.
Her last letter, in particular, had irritated him, for it contained hints that she was willing to help him to gain success in society and in the service, but not to help him live in a manner that scandalized all good society. His mother's wish to bribe him offended him to the bottom of his soul and increased his coldness toward her. Yet he could not go back on his generous promise, although, dimly foreseeing some eventualities of his connection with Anna, he felt that it had been too lightly given, and that, even though unmarried, he might need the whole 100,000 a year. But it was impossible to go back on it. He had only to remember his brother's wife, and how that dear, excellent Varya at every opportunity showed him that she remembered his generosity and appreciated it, to realize the impossibility of withdrawing what he had given. It was as impossible as to beat a woman, to steal, or to tell a lie. There was only one possible and necessary way out of it, on which Vronsky decided without a moment's hesitation. To borrow 10,000 rubles from a moneylender, which he could easily do, to cut down his expenses and to sell his racehorses. Having decided on this, he at once wrote a note to Rolandaki, who had more than once offered to buy his horses. Then he sent for the moneylender and the Englishman, and allotted what money he had among the different bills. Having finished this business, he wrote a cold and abrupt reply to his mother. Then, taking from his pocketbook 3 notes from Anna, he reread them, burnt them, and recalling a conversation he had had with her the evening before, fell into a reverie. Chapter 20. Vronsky was particularly fortunate in that he had a code of rules which clearly defined what should and should not be done. This code covered a very small circle of conditions, but it was unquestionable, and Vronsky, never going beyond that circle, never for a moment hesitated to do what had to be done. The code categorically determined that though the card sharper must be paid, the tailor need not be. That one may not lie to a man, but might to a woman. That one must not deceive anyone except a husband, that one must not forgive an insult but may insult others, and so on. These rules might be irrational and bad, but they were absolute, and in complying with them Vronsky felt at ease and could carry his head high. Only quite lately, in reference to his relations with Anna, had he begun to feel that his code did not quite meet all circumstances, and that the future presented doubts and difficulties for which he had no guiding principle. His present relations to her and her husband were clear and simple to him. They were very clearly and exactly defined in the code of rules by which he was guided. She was a respectable woman who had given him her love, and he loved her. Therefore she was for him a woman worthy of as much or even more respect than a legitimate wife. He would have let his hand be cut off before he would have allowed himself by word or hint to insult her, or fail to show her all the respect that a woman can possibly desire. His relations towards society were also clear. Everyone might know or suspect, but no one must dare to speak about the matter, or he was prepared to silence the speaker and make him respect the non-existent honour of the woman he loved. His relations to her husband were simplest of all. From the moment that Anna gave him her love, he considered his own right to her indefeasible. Her husband was only a superfluous person and a hindrance. No doubt he was in a pitiable position, but what was to be done? The only right the husband had was, weapon in hand, to demand satisfaction, and that Vronsky from the first was prepared to give him. But latterly, new inner relations had sprung up between himself and her, which frightened him by their indefiniteness. Only yesterday she had told him that she was pregnant, and he felt that this news and what she expected of him called for something that was not fully defined by his code of rules. He was taken by surprise, and at the moment when she told him of her condition, his heart had suggested his proposal to her to leave her husband. He had made this proposal, but now, thinking it over,
He saw clearly that it would be better to avoid that plan, and yet, while he told himself so, he feared that this might be wrong.
When I told her to leave her husband, that meant that she should unite herself with me. Am I ready for that? How can I take her away now that I have no money? No doubt I could arrange that, but how could I go away with her while I'm in the army? Having proposed it, I must be ready to carry it out. That is to say, I must find the money and leave the army.
He pondered. The question of whether to leave or not to leave the army led him to another private matter, almost the chief, though the secret, interest of his life. Ambition was the old motive of his childhood and youth, one which he did not acknowledge even to himself, but which was so strong a passion that it now struggled against his love. His first steps in society and in the service had been successful, but 2 years ago he had made a bad blunder. Wishing to show his independence and to get promotion, he had refused a post that was offered him, hoping that this refusal would enhance his value. But it turned out that he had been too bold, and he was passed over. Having then perforce to assume the role of an independent character, he played it very adroitly and cleverly, as though he had no grudge against anyone, did not feel himself at all offended, and only wished to be left in peace to enjoy himself. In reality, he had begun to feel dissatisfied about the time that he went to Moscow the year before. He felt that the role of the independent man, who could have anything but wanted nothing, was beginning to pall, and that many people were beginning to think he could never do anything more than be an honest, good-natured fellow. His intrigue with Anna Karenina, which had caused such a sensation and attracted so much notice in society, by investing him with fresh glamour, had for a while quieted the worm of ambition that gnawed him. But a week ago that worm had reawakened with fresh vigour. A playmate of his childhood and his fellow pupil at the cadet corps, Serpukhovsky, who belonged to the same social circle and who had finished the same year as himself and had been his rival in the classroom, at gymnastics, in mischief, and in ambitious dreams, had just returned from Central Asia, where he had gained 2 steps in official rank and had won a distinction rarely awarded to so young a general. As soon as he reached Petersburg, people began to talk about him as a rising star of the first magnitude. Of the same age as Vronsky and his messmate, Serpukhovsky was already a general expecting an appointment that might have an influence on state affairs, while Vronsky, though independent and brilliant and beloved by an enchanting woman, remained only a cavalry captain and was allowed to be as independent as he pleased. Of course I'm not jealous, and could not be jealous, of Serpukhovsky. But his promotion shows me that if one bides one's time, the career of such a man as myself may be very quickly made. 3 years ago he and I were in the same position. If I retire, I burn my boats. By remaining in the service, I lose nothing. She herself said that she did not want to change her position, and I, having her love, cannot envy Serpukhovsky. And slowly twisting his moustache, he rose from the table and walked across the room. His eyes shone with peculiar brightness, and he felt that firm, calm, and joyful mood which always came when he had cleared up the situation. Everything was clear and distinct, as after his former periodical stocktakings. He shaved, had a cold bath, dressed, and went out.
Chapter 21. "I have come for you. Your washing has taken a long time," said Petritsky. "Well, is it done?" "Yes, it's done," said Vronsky, smiling with his eyes and twirling the ends of his moustache as carefully as if, after the order he had established in his affairs, any too vigorous or rapid movement might upset it. "After it, you always look as if you've come out of a Russian bath," said Petritsky. "And I have come straight from Gritska," the name by which they called their commanding officer. "They're expecting you." Vronsky looked at his comrade without answering, thinking about something else.
Is that where the music is? He said, listening to the familiar strains, now audible, of brass instruments playing polkas and waltzes. What's up? Serpukhovsky has arrived.
Ah, I did not know, exclaimed Vronsky.
His smiling eyes shone still more brightly. Having made up his mind that he was happy in his love, and having sacrificed his ambitions to it, or at any rate assumed that role, Vronsky could no longer feel envious of Serpukhovsky, nor vexed with him for not coming straight to see him on reaching the regiment. Serpukhovsky was a good friend, and he was glad that he would see him.
I am very glad.
Damin, the CO, occupied a large country house, and the whole party were gathered together on the roomy veranda. In the grounds, what first met Vronsky's eyes were the soldier singers in their white linen uniforms, standing beside a cask of vodka, then the jolly, healthy figure of the CO surrounded by his officers. Having come out on the top step of the veranda, he was gesticulating, and above the noise of the band, which was playing a quadrille of Offenbachs, was loudly giving orders to some soldiers who were standing somewhat apart. A group of soldiers, a sergeant-major and some other non-commissioned officers, came up to the veranda at the same time as Vronsky. After returning to the table, the commander again came forward with a glass of champagne in his hand and announced a toast. To the health of our late comrade, the gallant general, Prince Serpukhovskoy! Hurrah! Following the commander, champagne glass in hand, Serpukhovskoy came down smiling.
You are growing younger every day, Bondarenko, he remarked to the ruddy-faced, smart-looking sergeant-major serving for a second term who stood just in front of him.
Vronsky had not seen Serpukhovskoy for 3 years. He had matured and had grown whiskers, but still had just as good a figure and was just as striking, not so much for his good looks as for the delicacy and nobility of his face and bearing. One change Vronsky noticed in him was that quiet and permanent radiance which comes upon the faces of people who have succeeded and feel assured that everybody recognizes their success. Vronsky knew that kind of radiance and noticed it at once on Serpukhovskoy's face. As he was descending the steps, Serpukhovskoy noticed Vronsky. A smile of joy lit up his face. He jerked his head backwards and raised his glass, welcoming Vronsky, and showing by this gesture that he must first go to the sergeant-major, who was already stretching himself and puckering his lips for a kiss.
"Ah, here he is," exclaimed the commander. "And Yashvin told me that you were in one of your dismal moods."
Serpukhovskoy kissed the smart-looking sergeant-major on his moist, fresh lips, and wiping his mouth on his handkerchief, stepped up to Vronsky.
"Well, I am glad,"
he said, taking him apart and pressing his hand.
"You look after him," shouted the commander to Yashvin, and went out to the soldiers.
"Why were you not at the races yesterday? I thought I should see you there," asked Vronsky, examining Serpukhovskoy.
"I did come, but late.
Excuse me," he added, and turned to his adjutant. "Please give order to distribute this money equally among the men."
He hurriedly took 300 100-ruble notes out of his pocketbook and blushed.
"Vronsky, will you eat something or have a drink?" said Yashvin. "Hey, bring the count something to eat. Here, drink this."
The carousing at the house of the CO continued long. They drank a great deal. Serpukhovskoy was lifted and tossed by the officers. Then the CO was tossed. Then the CO danced with Petritsky in front of the singers. After that, feeling rather weak, he sat down on a bench in the yard and began demonstrating to Yashvin Russia's superiority to Prussia, especially in cavalry charges, and the carousal quieted down for a moment. Serpukhovskoy went to the dressing room to wash his hands and found Vronsky there. Vronsky had taken off his coat and was washing his hairy red neck under the washstand tap, rubbing it and his head with his hands. When he had finished his ablutions, Vronsky sat down beside Serpukhovskoy on a little sofa in the dressing room and began a conversation of great interest to both of them.
"I used to hear all about you from my wife," said Serpukhovskoy. "I am glad you saw a good deal of her."
"She's friends with Varya, and they are the only women in Petersburg whom it is a pleasure for me to meet," said Vronsky with a smile. He smiled because he foresaw the turn their conversation would take, and was pleased.
"The only ones?" asked Serpukhovskoy, smiling.
"Yes, and I used to hear about you, but not only from your wife," said Vronsky, checking the hint by a serious look.
"I am very glad of your success, but not at all surprised. I expected even more."
Serpukhovskoy smiled. Vronsky's opinion of him evidently gave him pleasure, and he saw no reason to hide it.
"I, on the contrary, I must frankly admit, expected less. But I am pleased, very pleased. I am ambitious. It is my weakness, and I acknowledge it."
"Perhaps you would not if you were not successful," said Vronsky.
"I do not think so."
And Serpukhovskoy smiled again.
"I do not mean to say I could not live without it, but it would be a bore. Of course, I may be making a mistake, but I believe I have some capacity for the career I have adopted, and that in my hands, power of any kind, if I ever possess it, will be used in a better way than in the hands of many whom I know," said he with a radiant consciousness of success. "Therefore, the nearer I am to getting it, the more pleased I am."
"It may be so for you, but not for everyone."
"I used to think the same, yet here I am, living, and find that it is not worthwhile living for that alone," said Vronsky.
There you are, said Serpukhovskoy, laughing.
"I had begun by saying that I used to hear about you and your refusal. Of course, I approved of it. But there is a way of doing a thing, and I think that, though your action was good in itself, you did not do it the right way."
"What is done, and you know that I never go back on what I have done. Besides, I am quite all right."
"All right for a time. But you will not remain satisfied for long."
"I should not say that to your brother. He is a dear child, just like this host of ours. Hear him," he added, listening to the cries of hurrah.
"And he is happy.
But that would not satisfy you."
"I do not say that it would."
"And that is not all. Men like you are wanted."
"By whom?"
"By whom?
By society.
By Russia.
Russia is in need of men, needs a party. Without it, everything is going and will go to the dogs."
"What do you mean?
Bertenev's party, in opposition to the Russian communists?"
"No," said Serpukhovskoy, frowning with vexation at being suspected of such nonsense.
"Tu sai un blag. It always has existed and always will. There are no communists, whatever. But scheming people always have invented and always will invent some harmful and dangerous party. That's an old trick. What is wanted is an influential party of independent men like you and me."
"But why," Vronsky named several influential men,
"why are not they independent men?"
"Only because they have not, or had not by birth, an independent position, had no name, were not born as near the sun as we were. They can be bought by money or by affability and must invent a theory to keep their positions. And they bring forward some idea, some theory in which they themselves do not believe and which does harm, merely as a means of procuring government quarters and a salary.
Cela n'est pas plus fin que ça, if you happen to see their cards.
Maybe I am worse and more foolish than they, though I do not see why I am worse than they. Anyhow, you and I have one great advantage. We cannot be bought so easily. And such men are more needed than ever."
Vronsky listened attentively. But it was not so much the meaning of Serpukhovskoy's words that interested him as his outlook on these questions. For Serpukhovskoy was already dreaming of a struggle with the powers that be, and already had sympathies and antipathies in that sphere, whereas Vronsky's interest in the service was limited to his own squadron. Vronsky realized, too, how powerful Serpukhovskoy might become by his undoubted capacity for reflection and comprehension, and by his intellect and gift of speech, so seldom met with in the society in which he lived. And, ashamed as he was of the fact, he felt jealous. "All the same, I lack the most necessary thing," he replied. "I lack the wish for power. I had it once, but it is gone."
"Pardon me, that is not true," said Serpukhovskoy with a smile.
"Yes, it is. It is true. At present. To be quite frank," added Vronsky.
"Yes, it is true at present. That is another matter. But the present will not last forever."
"Perhaps," said Vronsky.
"You say perhaps," continued Serpukhovskoy, as if he had guessed Vronsky's thoughts, "but I say certainly. That is why I wanted to see you. You acted rightly. I quite understand it.
But you must not persevere in it. I only ask you to give me carte blanche. I am not patronizing you."
"Though why should I not patronize you? You have so often patronized me.
I hope our friendship is above that sort of thing."
"Yes," he said, with a smile tender as a woman's. "Give me carte blanche. Leave the regiment, and I will draw you on imperceptibly.
But try to understand that I do want nothing except that everything should remain as it is," said Vronsky. Serpukhovsky rose and said, as he stood before Vronsky, "You say that all should remain as it is?
I know what you mean, but hear me. We are both of the same age. It may be that in number you have known more women than I have."
The smile of Serpukhovskoy's face and his gesture showed that Vronsky need have no fear, and that he would touch the tender spot gently and carefully.
"But I am married, and believe me that, knowing only your wife whom you love, as somebody once said, you can understand all women better than if you knew thousands."
"We will come in a minute,"
Vronsky shouted to an officer who looked in, having been sent by the CO to call them. Vronsky was anxious now to hear the rest of what Serpukhovskoy had to say.
"Here is my opinion. Women are the chief stumbling block in a man's career. It is difficult to love a woman and do anything else. To achieve it and to love in comfort and unhampered, the only way is to marry. How am I to put to you what I think?"
And Serpukhovskoy, who was fond of similes, went on,
Wait a bit. Yes, if you had to carry a load and use your hands at the same time, it would be possible only if the load was strapped on your back, and that is marriage.
I found that out when I married. I suddenly had my hands free.
But if you drag that load without marriage, your hands are so full that you can do nothing else. Look at Matsankov, at Krupov. They have ruined their careers because of women."
"But what women?" said Vronsky, recalling the Frenchwoman and the actress with whom these men were entangled.
"So much the worse. The more assured the position of the woman in the world, the worse it is. That is not like merely dragging a load with one's hands. It is like wrenching it from someone else."
"You have never loved," said Vronsky, softly, with his eyes looking straight before him and with Anna in his thoughts.
"Perhaps not. But another point. Women are always more materialistic than men. Men make of love something enormous, but women are always terre à terre."
"Coming, coming,"
he said, turning to a footman who had entered. But the footman had not come to call them, as Serpukhovskoy thought. He brought Vronsky a note.
Your man brought this from the Princess Tverskaya.
Vronsky opened the note, and his face flushed.
My head has begun aching, he said. I shall go home. Well then, goodbye. Do you give me carte blanche? We'll talk it over another time. I will look you up in Petersburg.
Chapter 22. It was already past five, and in order not to be late and not to use his own horses, which were known to everybody, Vronsky took Yashvin's hired carriage and told the coachman to drive as fast as possible. The old four-seated hired vehicle was very roomy. He sat down in a corner, put his legs on the opposite seat, and began to think. A vague sense of the accomplished cleaning up of his affairs, a vague memory of Serpukhovskoy's friendship for him, and the flattering thought that the latter considered him a necessary man, and above all the anticipation of the coming meeting, merged into one general feeling of joyful vitality. This feeling was so strong that he could not help smiling. He put down his legs, threw one of them over the other, and placing his arm across it, felt its firm calf where he had hurt it in the fall the day before, and then, throwing himself back, sighed deeply several times.
Delightful! Oh, delightful! He thought.
He had often before been joyfully conscious of his body, but had never loved himself, his own body, as he did now. It gave him pleasure to feel the slight pain in his strong leg, to be conscious of the muscles of his chest moving as he breathed. That clear, cool August day which made Anna feel so hopeless seemed exhilarating and invigorating to him, and refreshed his face and neck, which were glowing after their washing and rubbing. The scent of brilliantine given off by his moustache seemed peculiarly pleasant in the fresh air. All that he saw from the carriage window through the cold, pure air in the pale light of the evening sky seemed as fresh, bright, and vigorous as he was himself. The roofs of the houses glittered in the evening sun. The sharp outlines of the fences and the corners of buildings, the figures of people and vehicles they occasionally met, the motionless verdure of the grass and trees, the fields of potatoes with their clear-cut ridges, the slanting shadows of the houses and trees, the bushes, and even the potato ridges. It was all pleasant and like a landscape newly painted and varnished.
"Get on! Get on!" he shouted to the coachman, thrusting himself out of the window.
And taking a 3-ruble note from his pocket, he put it into the man's hand as the latter turned round. The coachman felt something in his hand, the whip cracked, and the carriage rolled quickly along the smooth, macadamized high road.
"I want nothing, nothing but that happiness," he thought, staring at the ivory knob of the bell between the front windows of the carriage, his mind full of Anna as he had last seen her. "The longer it continues, the more I love her. And here is the garden of Rada's country house. Where is she? Where? Why has she given me an appointment here, in a letter from Betsy?" he thought.
But there was no longer any time for thinking. Before reaching the avenue, he ordered the coachman to stop, opened the carriage door, jumped out while the carriage was still moving, and went up the avenue leading to the house. There was no one in the avenue, but turning to the right, he saw her. Her face was veiled, but his joyous glance took in that special manner of walking peculiar to her alone, the droop of her shoulders, the poise of her head, and immediately a thrill passed like an electric current through his body, and with renewed force he became conscious of himself from the elastic movement of his firm legs to the motion of his lungs as he breathed, and of something tickling his lips. On reaching him, she clasped his hand firmly.
You're not angry that I told you to come? It was absolutely necessary for me to see you, she said. And at sight of the serious and severe expression of her mouth under her veil, his mood changed at once.
I? Angry?
But how did you get here? Never mind, she said, putting her hand on his arm. Come, I must speak to you. He felt that something had happened, and that this interview would not be a happy one. In her presence he had no will of his own. Without knowing the cause of her agitation, he became infected by it.
What is it?
What? He asked, pressing her hand against his side with his elbow and trying to read her face. She took a few steps in silence to gather courage, and then suddenly stopped.
I did not tell you last night, she began, breathing quickly and heavily, that on my way back with Alexei Alexandrovich I told him everything. Said I could not be his wife, and I told him all.
He listened, involuntarily leaning forward with his whole body as if trying to ease her burden. But as soon as she had spoken, he straightened himself, and his face assumed a proud and stern expression.
Yes. Yes, that is better. 1,000 times better. I understand how hard it must have been for you, he said.
But she was not listening to his words, only trying to read his thoughts from his face. She could not guess that it expressed the first idea that had entered Vronsky's mind, the thought of an inevitable duel. Therefore she explained that momentary look of severity in another way. After reading her husband's letter, she knew in the depths of her heart that all would remain as it was, that she would not have the courage to disregard her position and give up her son in order to be united with her lover. The afternoon spent at the Princess Tverskaya's house had confirmed that thought. Yet this interview was still of extreme importance to her. She hoped that the meeting might bring about a change in her position and save her. If at this news he would firmly, passionately, and without a moment's hesitation say to her, "Give up everything and fly with me," she would abandon her son and go with him. But the news had not the effect on him that she had desired. He only looked as if he had been offended by something. It was not at all hard for me. It all came about of itself, she said, irritably. And here. She pulled her husband's note from under her glove.
I understand, he interrupted, taking the note, but not reading it, and trying to soothe her. I only want one thing. I only ask for one thing. To destroy this situation in order to devote my life to your happiness.
Why do you tell me this? She said. Do you think I could doubt it?
If I doubted it,
who's that coming? Said Vronsky, pointing to two ladies who are coming toward them. They may know us. And he moved quickly in the direction of a sidewalk, drawing her along with him.
Oh, I don't care, she said.
Her lips trembled, and her eyes seemed to him to be looking at him with strange malevolence from under the veil.
As I was saying, that's not the point. I cannot doubt that. But see what he writes to me. Read.
She stopped again. Again, as at the first moment when he heard the news of her having spoken to her husband, Vronsky yielded to the natural feeling produced by the thoughts of his relation to the injured husband. Now that he held his letter, he could not help imagining to himself the challenge that he would no doubt find waiting for him that evening or next day, and the duel, when he would be standing with the same cold, proud look as his face bore that moment, and having fired into the air would be awaiting the shot from the injured husband. And at that instant, the thought of what Serpukhovskoy had just been saying to him, and of what had occurred to him that morning, that it was better not to bind himself, flashed through his mind, and he knew that he could not pass on the thought to her. After he had read the letter, he looked up at her, but his look was not firm. She understood at once that he had already considered this by himself, knew that whatever he might say he would not tell her all that he was thinking,
and knew that her last hopes had been deceived. This was not what she had expected.
"You see what a man he is," she said in a trembling voice. "He..."
"Forgive me, but I am glad of it," Vronsky interrupted. "For God's sake, hear me out," he added, with an air of entreaty that she would let him explain his words. "I am glad because I know that it is impossible, quite impossible, for things to remain as they are, as he imagines."
"Why impossible?"
said Anna, forcing back her tears and clearly no longer attaching any importance to what he would say. She felt that her fate was decided. Vronsky wanted to say that after what he considered to be the inevitable duel, it could not continue. But he said something else. "It cannot continue. I hope that you will now leave him. I hope..." He became confused and blushed. "That you will allow me to arrange and to think out a life for ourselves. Tomorrow..." he began, but she did not let him finish.
"And my son?" she exclaimed. "You see what he writes? I must leave him, and I cannot do that, and do not want to."
"But for heaven's sake, which is better, to leave your son or to continue in this degrading situation?"
"Degrading for whom?"
"For everybody, and especially for you."
"You call it degrading? Oh, do not call it that. Such words have no meaning for me," she replied, tremulously.
She did not wish him to tell untruths now. She had only his love left, and she wanted to love him.
"Try to understand that since I loved you, everything has changed for me. There is only one single thing in the world for me. Your love. If I have it, I feel so high and firm that nothing can be degrading for me. I am proud of my position because... proud of... proud..."
She could not say what she was proud of. Tears of shame and despair choked her. She stopped and burst into sobs. He also felt something rising in his throat, and for the first time in his life he felt ready to cry. He could not explain what it was that had so moved him. He was sorry for her and felt that he could not help her, because he knew that he was the cause of her trouble, that he had done wrong. "Would divorce be impossible?" he asked weakly. She silently shook her head. "Would it not be possible to take your son away with you and go away all the same?"
"Yes, but all that depends on him."
"Now I go back to him," she said dryly. Her foreboding that everything would remain as it was had not deceived her. "On Tuesday I shall go back to Petersburg and everything will be decided." "Yes," she said. "But don't let us talk about it." Anna's carriage, which she had sent away and ordered to return to the gate of the Vreda garden, drove up. Anna took leave of Vronsky and went home.
Chapter 23. On Monday, the usual meeting of the committee of the 2nd of July took place. Karenin entered the council room, greeted the members and the president as usual, and took his seat, his hand lying ready on the papers before him. Among these papers were the statistics that he needed and a draft of the statement he was going to make. But he did not really require the figures. He remembered them all, and did not even consider it necessary to go over in his mind what he was going to say. He knew that when the time came, and he saw his opponent before him vainly trying to look indifferent, his speech would naturally be far more fluent and better than if he prepared it beforehand. He felt that the contents of his speech would be so important that every word would be significant. Yet, as he listened to the general reports, his face wore a most innocent and artless look.
Looking at his white hands with the thick veins and the delicate long fingers toying with the two edges of a white sheet of paper before him, and at his head wearily bent to one side, no one would have expected that words would flow from his lips which would raise a terrible storm and make the members shout each other down, forcing the president to call them to order. When the reports had been heard, Karenin, in his quiet, thin voice, informed the meeting that he wished to bring to their notice some considerations of his own on the question of the settlement of the native races, and the attention of the meeting turned to him. Karenin cleared his throat, and, as was his wont when making a speech, without looking at his opponent, he fixed his eyes on the first man opposite him, a quiet little old man who never had any views in connection with the special committee, and began to explain his considerations. When he came to the fundamental and organic law, his opponent jumped up and began to raise objections. Stremov, who was also on the special committee, stung to the quick, began justifying himself, and the meeting became quite a stormy one. But Karenin triumphed, and his motion was carried. Three new special committees were formed, and the next day nothing was talked about in a certain Petersburg set but that meeting. Karenin's success was even greater than he had expected. When he woke on the Tuesday morning, he recalled with pleasure his victory of the previous day, and could not help smiling, even while wishing to appear indifferent, when the secretary, with a desire to flatter him, reported the rumours that had reached him concerning what had happened at the meeting. Busy with the secretary, Karenin quite forgot that it was Tuesday, the day fixed for Anna's return, and was surprised and unpleasantly startled when the footman came in to inform him of her arrival. Anna returned to Petersburg early in the morning, and as she had wired that the carriage should be sent for her, he might have expected her. But he did not come out to meet her when she arrived. She was told that he had not yet come out of his study, where he was busy with his secretary. She sent word to her husband that she had arrived, and went to her boudoir, where she set to work sorting her things, expecting that he would come in to see her. But an hour passed, and he did not come. She went down into the dining room on a plea of giving orders, and purposely spoke in a loud voice, thinking that he would come. But although she heard him go out of the study door to take leave of the secretary, he did not come to her. She knew that, according to his habit, he would soon go away to his work, and she wished to see him first. She passed through the ballroom to his study and resolutely went in. When she entered, he was sitting in his official uniform, evidently ready to start, with his elbows on a little table, looking wearily in front of him. She saw him before he saw her, and knew that he was thinking about her. When he saw her, he was about to rise, but changed his mind as his face flushed, a thing Anna had never seen it do before. However, he quickly rose and came toward her, looking not at her eyes, but at her forehead and hair. He came up, took her hand, and asked her to sit down.
"I am very glad you have come," he said, sitting down beside her.
He evidently wished to say something, but faltered. Several times he tried to speak, but stopped. Although, while preparing for this interview, she had been teaching herself to despise and blame him, she did not know what to say, and pitied him. There was silence for some time.
"Is Seretse well?" he asked,
and without waiting for a reply, he added,
"I am not dining at home today, and must be going at once."
"I meant to go away to Moscow," she said.
"Oh, no, you were quite right to come," he replied, and again became silent.
Seeing that he had not the strength to begin, she began for him.
"Alexei Alexandrovich," she said, studying his face
and without dropping her eyes under his gaze fixed on her hair,
"I am a guilty woman, and a bad one. But I am what I was before, as I then told you. I have come to tell you now I cannot make any change."
"I am not questioning you about it," he replied suddenly in a firm tone and looking with hatred straight into her eyes. "I had expected it." Under the influence of anger, he had evidently regained perfect self-possession.
"But I repeat again what I then told you and subsequently wrote," he went on in a shrill, thin voice. "I again repeat that I will not know it. I ignore it as long as it is not known to the rest of the world, as long as my name is not dishonoured. Therefore, I warn you that our relations must remain what they have been, and that if you let yourself be compromised, I shall be obliged to take measures to safeguard my honour."
"But our relations cannot be what they were before," Anna began in a timid voice, looking at him with frightened eyes. When she saw his quiet gestures, heard his shrill, childish, and sarcastic voice, her repulsion toward him destroyed the pity she had felt for him, and she now experienced nothing but fear and anxiety to clear up the situation at any cost.
"I cannot be your wife, since I..." she began.
He laughed in a cruel, cold manner.
"I suppose the kind of life you have chosen has affected your principles. I respect or despise both so much, I respect your past and despise your present, that the interpretation you give to my words was far from my thoughts."
Anna sighed and hung her head.
"I cannot understand, however, that with your independent mind," he went on, getting heated, "informing your husband of your infidelity and appearing to see nothing unseemly in it, you should consider it unseemly to continue to fulfill a wife's duties to her husband."
"Alexei Alexandrovich, what do you want of me?"
"What I want is not to meet that person here, and for you to behave in such a way that neither society nor the servants shall be able to accuse you. For you not to see that man. I think that is not much to ask.
And in return, you will enjoy all the advantages of a wife without fulfilling her duties. That is all I have to say.
Now, I must be going, and I shan't be back to dinner."
He rose and went toward the door. Anna, too, rose. He stopped and let her pass first. Chapter 24. The night Lievin had spent on the haycock had not passed without leaving its mark. He became disgusted with the agricultural pursuits on which he was engaged and lost all interest in them. In spite of the splendid harvest, he had never, or thought he had never, encountered so many failures or so much hostility from the peasants as that year. And the cause of those failures and that hostility were now quite plain to him. The delight he had felt in the labour itself, occasioned by his having drawn nearer to the peasants, his jealousy of them, his envy of their life, his desire to adopt that kind of life, which had not been a mere desire that night but a real intention, the details of which he had considered, all these things together had so changed his outlook on the working of his estate that he could no longer feel his former interest in the work, or help noticing the unpleasant relation to the labourer on which it was all based. Herds of cattle of an improved breed like Pava, the tilled land ploughed with good ploughs, the 9 fields surrounded with willows, the hundreds of acres of deeply manured land, the seed drills and all such things, were splendid if they could be worked by himself alone or with the help of friends and people in sympathy with him. But now he clearly saw, the book on agriculture which he was writing, in which the labourer was the chief factor in farming, helped much in this direction, that the agricultural work he was carrying on was founded on a bitter and obstinate struggle between himself and his labourers, in which on the one side, his, there was a continual and strenuous attempt to bring everything into accord with what were considered the